you suffering from human giver syndrome? With school in full swing and as we head into the holiday season, we all know that burnout is real. But today on Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network, we're going to look at what you can do to manage burnout. Julie and Ginger are going to share their thoughts after reading the New York Times bestseller, Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. Let's listen in.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Regulated and Relational, our podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Julie Beam.
And I'm Ginger Healy.
And we're excited to share with you our personal experiences and professional knowledge of what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. Today, we're going to depart a little from our traditional format because Ginger and I, last summer, both decided to read the same book. It's called Burnout by Emily and Amelia Nagoski. They're twin sisters. And if you've heard of or read this book, then you're going to be able to relate to what we're talking about. And if you haven't, you need to listen in because it was really powerful, wasn't it, Ginger?
Extremely powerful. I felt like it was life-changing. I breezed through it. I could not put it down and immediately started calling my mom, my friends, all the women in my life that I felt like, and not just women, but particularly women in my life that I felt like needed to be validated and affirmed of all these feelings that were there that I knew about and feelings that were there that I didn't know about that kind of rose to the surface as I read this book. And so I just knew that it would be a perfect subject for a podcast to really talk about.
Exactly. Well, I did the same thing. I read it while I was on vacation with my daughter, who's expecting a baby, and my sister. And we had great conversations. I mean, every morning at coffee, I would tell them about the chapter I had just read, and we had great conversations around it. I'm pretty sure that they're both reading it by now, too, just because of that.
Yeah, I know my mom is. I talked to her, you know, just a couple of days ago, and she said, oh my gosh, that book you recommended. And I said, I know, say no more. I know exactly where your thoughts and heart and mind is after reading it. So really good stuff. I cannot wait to dive in. I loved from even before page one in the intro, they dedicated it for the givers. And I think that's kind of what, you know, hit me and set the tone was that this is information for anyone who has felt overwhelmed and exhausted, yet worried they aren't doing enough. And I just kind of sat with that for a minute because I thought, well, that is me and a lot of people in my life. So that's kind of where we're headed for this, that this information, you know, is for you. So why don't we go ahead and start talking about, you know, the title of the book is Burnout. So what is burnout? And these women defined burnout as containing the following three components. The first one being emotional exhaustion, right? That is a little bit deeper than just being tired. It's fatigue that comes from caring too much for too long. And so we can all kind of feel that in our daily lives. The second component is depersonalization. It happens when the depiction of empathy and caring and compassion, we start to kind of lose that because we don't have enough energy behind it from that deep emotional exhaustion and burnout. And then the third one is a decreased sense of accomplishment. And that's when we start to feel kind of futile in our efforts, feeling that nothing we do makes a difference. And I know for me, I'm doing all day long, but there does come that time when it's like, I'm doing, but I can't see results. I can't feel the results. And it's a really defeating feeling.
I know it's a good checkpoint for me when I start saying either out loud, sometimes I say it out loud, sometimes I just keep it in my head. I don't care, whatever. Yeah. I don't care. So if that's my emotional level around something, it's a good indicator to me that I need to go, wait a minute. You know, I used to care about that. You know, seriously, it's a good signal, a good road sign to go, wait, you know, what do you mean? Whatever. Yeah. Not what I'm really feeling. It's just the burnout. The exhaustion. Right.
In another day or time, would you feel differently? Would you want to feel differently? So I think the most important part that we need to point out here is how highly prevalent burnout is. So if you're hearing this, just know you are not alone. This is very common, very prevalent, and extremely important that we talk about, because the other point that we want to bring out here is that burnout is actually dangerous. Emotional exhaustion is strongly linked to negative impacts on health, relationships, and work. And that's what we're going to talk about, how it affects us, you know, our health. We've spoken before about ACEs in our adverse childhood experiences in this podcast, and how negatively those experiences can affect your health, can actually shorten your lifespan. And that's what we're talking about here too, the dangerous impacts it has on health. And then of course, we understand how work and relationship can be so negatively impacted as well. So that's your little intro. I'm really excited to kind of dive in here and talk about the other portion of this title, if you've noticed, was Burnout, the Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. So here we have a stress cycle. Our autonomic nervous system has to go through this cycle. And we always, at least I was kind of thinking of it in terms of once the stress has stopped, then the cycle has stopped. But what we're learning here from this book and from other things, that it's just not as smooth as that. We have to actually physically, physiologically complete that stress cycle, make sure that it is a full completion. And so we're going to talk about how to do that. But one thing that might help us as we talk about it is to kind of define the difference between stress and stressors. Stressors are what activates the stress response in the body. It's, you know, whatever happened, it could be a myriad of different things. But stress itself is the neurobiological and physiological shift that happens in your body when you encounter that threat. So it's an evolutionarily adaptive response that helps us cope, and your entire body and mind actually change in response to that threat. And that's where we've spoken in the past about that fight, flight, freeze, those responses. That's what we're referring to here.
Right. I think one of the things I really love about this book is how closely they marry all of the brain science and the science, and they talk about it being important to understand the science. And then they layer all those rich stories about the women that give example and rich analogies. They talk about your stress cycle, completing it as if you were going through a tunnel, and that sometimes you get stuck in the tunnel, your emotions get stuck. And the first thing I highlighted was clear back in the introduction, in a simple sentence that said, exhaustion happens when we get stuck in an emotion. And I thought, that's interesting. So it's like that emotion sort of gets like a traffic jam in the tunnel, right? And it can't get on through, that you have to do things in that stress cycle to relieve the stress from your body. I was like you, Ginger. I was thinking, okay, I have a stress situation and I focus more on the stressor. And once the stressor is done, the work deadline is met, the child who's having a meltdown is taking a nap, the whatever it is, then the problem is solved and I feel better. Except the truth is, I don't always feel better. And sometimes I know that. And sometimes I just don't let myself know that because the emotion is still stuck in my body.
Yeah.
Right. And that's really the whole point. When they start talking about how those emotions that you feel get stuck is because you have stressors that can be chronic and happen over and over and over again. Like if you go to a job that stresses you out, that has, you know, constant stressors, and the chronic stress either at home or at work is when the stress outpaces your capacity to process it, right? To do something about it. And we all have done things to relieve our stress, but whether we do it purposefully every time we have those stressors. That was a huge aha for me, was talking about being so purposeful about what we do for the stress release. We also can get stuck in our stressors because it's socially appropriate to do that. It's socially appropriate to be nice, to be strong, to not cry, all of those things. And sometimes, you know, it's not saying that that social appropriateness is something we should just uproot and not have anymore. Sometimes you don't want to show your emotions in front of people because it can have such big ramifications. But sitting on those and squashing those feelings is a good way to get them stuck in the tunnel, right?
Right. You know, I like what you said about, like, it sometimes you do want to put those off, but now knowing that that's fine, as long as you eventually, hopefully not sooner than later, make sure you resolve them. And so for me, it was this having this new awareness of you need to go in and make sure those feelings are resolved, rather than, oh, well, the moment's over, the moment has passed, so move on, when in reality, you've just kind of postponed it.
The truth is, you can't really move on. You're going to be stuck there if you don't go ahead and process that and let it go in some way. The last thing that they point out is that sometimes we squash our feelings just to remain safe. It's a survival situation. And they gave an example of a woman being catcalled by construction workers, and that it would probably be dangerous for her, or it could prove to be dangerous for her to, you know, it's socially inappropriate for her to address them in a negative way and let them know that that's not appropriate. But even beyond that, depending on what situation she was in, it could be physically dangerous if she took on somebody in that way. And so sometimes you have to do that. But then you also have to do something about it, even if it's calling your girlfriend and saying, you won't believe the awful thing that just happened to me. You know, you've got to do something to work through that stress response.
I think what happens oftentimes is we think we're dealing with it. What I'm realizing is I thought I dealt with it, but I didn't. So maybe I used denial, or maybe I ignored it, or maybe I just powered through, you know, pulled up my britches and put on that strong face, thinking that that was actually healthy, when in reality, it was just, you know, postponing it. And they talked about it simmering away in our chemistry. And that was kind of a powerful metaphor to me too. So
the other thing I really liked about it is that there's practical ideas about how to complete the stress response cycle. And they're so practical and focused in on the fact that what we're trying to do is make a physiological shift, right? This isn't about just saying to your thinking brain, okay, I'm going to get over the fact that this guy was rudely suggestive, or this person did this, or my boss, you know, had come in with these big demands, or whatever our stressor is. It's not talking ourselves out of that emotion. It's recognizing that we have to do something to tell our body that it's okay, that we're safe again, and that we can let go of that big negative fight, flight, or freeze response, right?
Yeah. I really liked that they said the stress is not the problem. It's how you cope, because you and I have talked about in previous podcasts that there are stressors that are not bad for us. Stress isn't necessarily bad. What's bad is being stuck. You know, because we've all coped during stressful times, but that we need to, you know, learn how to manage the stress. That's why we talked about regulation and spent a lot of time talking about regulation. It's how we cope. So yeah, why don't we go ahead and go through some of these ways to complete the stress response cycle? Because I think you'll find that they're easy, they're doable, and that once we become aware that making that physiological shift isn't as difficult as we think it might be, but it is extremely necessary.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, the first one that's obvious to many, to all the endorphin addicted runners in the world, is to exercise, right? What I loved about this book is that one of the sisters, I think it's Amelia doesn't like to exercise. And I was like, preach, sister, that's me. I don't like to exercise. I don't get the physical pleasure from it that apparently other people are finding because they keep doing it. I understand why I should exercise. I love to take walks, ride bikes occasionally, and there are other things I do like to do, but it's not my go-to for completing the cycle.
They pulled the shame out of this suggestion, letting us know that exercise is also another word for movement and keeping busy and doing, and that it's just action-based. So, but that there are other ways, you know, exercise is not the only one.
You know, and I mean, they suggested other things. And I think even gardening was in that sound. I was like, okay, well, yeah, I could pull some weeds and that would probably relieve some of my stress is pulling some weeds. They talked about breathing and obviously, that's good mindfulness practice that we use with children, both as parents and teachers a lot too, is teaching a controlled breathing pattern, and so very important.
I think what happens sometimes is when we're in a stressful situation, we actually hold our breath, leaves us in a physiological state of stuck. So actually the simple act of breathing moves us forward and shifts us in a neurophysiological way.
Well, I like to just take a quick breath check two or three times a day during work. If I'm working on a project and I've been doing that for an hour or so, I'm thinking, okay, the least I can do is stand up and stretch and just take some deep breaths. I'm always amazed at how much clearer and more creative I am just in that little bit of feeding my body and brain that breath. Social interaction, which of course is what I had suggested earlier, calling your girlfriend, you know, like sharing that stress with somebody seems to help it dissipate a little bit, not stressing them out, but sharing what your feelings are really does help, and not holding it into yourself. And hopefully you have one or two people that can listen to you and help you decompress.
That's why we also named the podcast Regulated and Relational. Because we cannot emphasize enough how important it is to have stable, committed people in your life that support you, validate you, affirm you. And for me, just every so often give me a reality check of I'm being seen, I'm safe, you know, and they comfort me. And we cannot heal in isolation.
Yeah. You have to be seen and heard. You just have to. Number four is a Beam family favorite, and that is laughter. Everything in our world can be healed with laughter. At least that's how we do play it at my house. And that's right down to the deepest, darkest times in my life. One, when we had this prolonged legal battle that I had to spend several days in court on the witness stand, I literally would come home so stressed, so wiped. I was so exhausted, but I wasn't even hungry. You know how like you're past mealtime, but you can't eat because you're that exhausted. And I would plop down in front of the TV and put in one of about two movies that just make me laugh and laugh and laugh. And the kinds that you can watch over again and still laugh out loud about. And I would laugh out loud. And that relieved enough stress. I mean, it was such a great example of what they're talking about physiologically, that the rest of my body was like, oh, you are both hungry and needing to go to sleep. I mean, like the rest of my physiological messaging came back on board, right? And said, hey, by the way, you now need a meal and to go to bed. But until then, I would never have been able to do that without the laughter. We're big on that. We watch a lot of funny shows. We tell a lot of jokes. We find each other hilarious. So we have a lot of running family jokes. We post a lot of Far Side cartoons all over places because that's been one of our saving graces is bringing laughter.
Yeah, I agree.
So affection is another one. And of course, that dovetails well into the relational, and especially when you're talking about the attachment cycle for children and you're talking about physical touch, safe physical touch, and just genuine love and affection for each other. Not solve your problem kind of affection, but just being there and holding space. Being
present. And a lot of people find this through pets. And so I think that we're not just talking about human affection, but other affection as well.
Yeah, those dogs and cats and other pets are so, so critical. And nothing like one of them sitting on your lap and being petted. I mean, you're getting such physical, the weight and the touch and all of that. Number six was crying. I'm a huge crier too, huge believer in crying as relief.
There is a release is the word, you know, that comes. It's a release and a relief. And so our bodies are made to express that. And there's something to be said for crying it out, which is a term that also really means that you are letting it out.
As a young woman in corporate life, I fought that urge to cry in stressful situations, even though it was like big in me. I don't fight it. As an old woman in not so corporate in the nonprofit world, I just excuse myself and go take that cry, or actually sometimes tell people, hey, I got to go cry in the other room for a few minutes and then I'll be fine. Yeah. I mean, seriously, it works. There is a social stigma around that as a weakness, which is really sad, because it's such an efficient way to get your physiology back on track, to let go of that.
I mean, we're actually made to do that. And it is something that I hope that we teach our children. It's okay to feel what you are feeling rather than deny the authentic, you know, being of what's happening in the moment. You feel what you feel, you cry it out, and then you can move on. But otherwise, you can
really crying never hurts anybody. You might feel like throwing something, and so you should throw something like a pillow or something, but you'd be less likely to hurt people by crying than you do by some other expressions of your big, big negative feelings, right?
Well, and what we are learning is that your health can be negatively impacted if you deny what's happening inside. And so that's a way of saying, I feel sad. I feel overwhelmed. I need to release it. And then I can move on.
My crying is generally a feeling of overwhelmed in those kinds of situations. And then my interesting cry over joy has always captivated my daughter, whose background's in trauma. She's like, you're crying because you feel really happy. And I said, it's not the kind of emotion. It's the intenseness of the emotion that makes the crying. You know, it's like when it's over the top with it is when the crying happens. Creative expression is another way. And by that, it means a little bit of everything, whatever it is, whether it's writing, whether it's art, whether it's movement, whether it's, you know, any way that you're creative and creating.
Yeah. And actually, I loved Brené Brown in one of her books talked about creating something out of nothing, the power in that, that you did that. It uses a different part of your brain and it feels good. And it is a complete shift in your body state. And it's a powerful thing that keeps us moving and out of a state of stuck. So I loved that one because now I've read enough and understand enough to know how powerful it is to make something, even if it's not something tangible.
What is it for you? What's your favorite creative?
You know, I like writing music and I like singing and I would love to paint, but I just don't have those capabilities. So I admire those who do, but a lot of times for me, it is music or writing.
Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm not very creative either physically in terms of artistic. I find crocheting and yarn work to be highly stress relieving. Between the tacticalness of the yarn and the actual, I have a finished product that I did something with.
Yeah. I mean, even the simple act of doodling, we have learned in neuroscience, the powerful shift that that can do. And I would say that that's an act of creative expression as well. So
we need to load up on those tools and use them to help release our stress. Don't talk ourselves out of the importance of doing those things, for sure. So the second huge concept in this book was something called human giver syndrome. And that was pretty fascinating, don't you think, Ginger?
I mean, it rang really true to me, but I hadn't really seen it or taken it in quite the same as reading it. And so it was very powerful to me. I think there was so much affirmation here.
Yes, I agree. And it's the concept that there are human beings and then there are human givers, that people who are giving of themselves to humanity so that the others can be more whole, be more complete. There are people who have behaviors and patterns of behaviors associated with that and are almost, they didn't use the word groomed to be, but that's kind of what it is. And the truth is, society-wise, that is very often the females, the women of our society. And so that was these authors' points, is that we have to be aware that this kind of human giver syndrome is putting pressure on us, putting a stressor on us. So they define it this way. They say, do you suffer from human giver syndrome? So I'm reading straight from their book. Symptoms include believing that you have a moral obligation, that is, that you owe it to your partner, your family, the world, or even yourself to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, and attentive to the needs of others. Do you believe that any failure to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, or attentive makes you a failure as a person? Do you believe that your failure means you deserve to be punished and you even go so far as to beat yourself up? And do you believe that these are not symptoms, but that these are just normal, true ideas? The ending one, of course, is the crux of that, that you just assume that that is the way life is and go on without questioning that. And who cannot say yes to most of them? I mean, we've done it to ourselves as a society and to women in particular to gear things that way. And I don't mean that as a whole political uprising sort of thing. I just mean that women have to be aware that, as they put it, the game is rigged. The scales are tipped a little bit, that we are carrying a heavier giving load than leads to carrying a heavier stress load, because there's stress on constantly having to give and give and give of yourself.
When we just keep giving and there's nothing left, how hard it is for us to say no, that toll that it takes. I was on an airplane this weekend and a gentleman came up to me and said, do you mind if we switch seats? And, you know, I said, yes. I regretted that decision, but I didn't even think about it. You know, I didn't even pause. It was like, yeah, I think it's kind of my duty, moral obligation, whatever.
Well, you probably didn't even think about it. You just did it out of conditioning of that's the nice thing to do.
Yeah, it wasn't until later when the seat that I had switched to is at the very back of the plane, far away from the rest of my family, that I was like, oh gosh, you know. And then later my son came back and said, you know, you didn't have to say yes. And it was like, well, I know, but internally I didn't in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
What a journey.
Well, and it really is hard. I read this section and I agreed with everything that they said, that we are conditioned that way. But I also kept thinking, yeah, but being a service to other people isn't a bad thing. It's only a bad thing when it starts stressing us out, right? When it becomes too much and we don't have anybody who's being a service to us.
There's not necessarily anything wrong with me switching seats on a plane. And I pride myself on being a really nice, kind person. I love to give. There is a difference between that and I had given, 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 given. And in that moment, it wasn't about the seat, you know, it was about what I needed and wasn't being given back to. I like what they say here, that the human giver syndrome, it's a villain in our story because it tries to make you ignore something larger you're supposed to dedicate all your resources to human beings, but how can we escape or defeat the villain in our own story when we're busy policing others to keep them from defeating it?
So in a way, when we just give and give and give, then the people around us, the beings that are receiving but not giving, don't get to serve and learn that bigger meaning. Does that make sense? We're keeping them from learning to serve something larger, and we are also not serving something larger because we're busy making sure everybody in our world sees us as pretty calm, nice, and that they're all taken care of.
Yeah. I mean, especially as a mom, I'm seeing that, you know, I want my children to learn that mom is also a person. Mom is also a human being that has feelings and feels pain. But if I am constantly giving and serving to my children, which I do, and I actually do a great job at it, and I love it, but at some point I can't continue to give and do a good job and model to them how to take care of myself, I'm not really showing any self-compassion. And so then how are they going to learn that for themselves and for others as well?
Yeah. And so the sisters go on and talk about having meaning in your life and how that seems to be the antidote or antithesis of that human giver syndrome, that you can get whatever's meaningful to you because it enhances your well-being is something that is going to help you feel less stress and less burnout than just the giver, giver, giver. That's all based upon, you know, personal and cultural beliefs about what we should do. And we're our own worst enemies in that giver, giver business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of my time in my job convincing other moms how much they need to take care of themselves, or they cannot take care of those in their lives. And I truly believe that, but internalizing that is another step in this journey, you know, of how to do that. So that's what I really liked about that, this book as well, is where do we go from here?
Obviously, we have just scratched the surface of the content of this book. There's way more. I do want to talk about one more thing in closing. I don't want to give you the whole book because I want you all to go read it. There's stories, then there's practical applications. There's actually charts to fill out and things to think about if you want to start working towards being more intentional in some of these ways. Such good stuff. The last thing that really resonated with me, and it may not with you, Ginger, or the listeners, was they had a whole chapter on, I think they called it the Bikini Industrial Complex, and they talked about weight and about the way that we look at weight and body image and how not only unsupportive and stressing that is, but actually how downright dangerous some of that is. And they cited some very interesting science around that. And being a woman in particular, you know, that whole body image conversation just is right there. And if you're the mom of daughters, you know, it's right there in your face. And if you work around women, you know, you're always talking to each other about all of that.
I just want to read a couple things out of this and share this really quick story from the book, because ever since I read it, I can't quit thinking about it. But it says, by the age of six, about half of girls are worried about being too fat. Six years old. It increases from there. But the story is about the island of Fiji. In 1994, there was no television on the island of Fiji. And interestingly enough, there were no eating disorders. But in 1995, television was brought to the island. And by 1998, just 3 years later, 29% of the girls on the island of Fiji had developed a severe eating disorder symptoms. 13% developed these symptoms within 1 month of the introduction of television. And so it's pretty shocking to know that media sells thinness, and that's an ideal that is literally unobtainable. And they went on to talk about how the BMI chart was created by 7 people who were employed by weight loss clinics. So a lot of stuff that just kind of blew my mind and has created this paradigm under which we live and act and believe that is false, you know, that is absolutely unobtainable. My favorite quote from that chapter was that weight and health are not the same thing. So we have to know that and understand that.
Exactly. And then, of course, they go on in that chapter to point out that part of the reason that people equate weight with health is that there's such a stigma around the weight and how dangerous it is to be overweight on an emotional level, because you are discriminated against and bullied, and, you know, and even acts of people who mean well to talk to you about the weight issue, like you didn't have looked in the mirror and noticed that you were overweight,
right?
You know, right? And they're doing it, and sometimes even tell you they're doing it because they're concerned about your health, when in reality, they're more concerned about how you're getting along socially, because they know it's socially a stumbling block for so many people. It brought about many interesting conversations. Like I said, when I was reading this summer on vacation with my sister and my daughter, we come from a family where weight happens a lot, especially as you age. And so we had a lot of conversations about, you know, how not to get hung up in the body image and how hard that was, how difficult that was to navigate yourself through that. Especially as a woman, we change sizes several times in our lives. We just do. And, you know, most women do change sizes several times in their lives. Dealing with that is a huge stressor for a lot of people. So in case you can't tell it, Ginger and I really love this book and we really highly recommend it. It is called Burnout, with the subtitle, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle, by sisters Emily and Amelia Nagasi. They've got fantastic insight and advice and encouragement. Just reading the book will make you feel supported if you are struggling with some burnout and struggling to get through that stress cycle.
And listen, I read a lot of books about trauma and depression and anxiety because it's part of my job. And that can be in and of itself a depressing thing. But I will tell you, this book also made me laugh out loud. They tell it, you know, with some really fun stories and great sense of humor. So it's not one of those that you think, oh, I probably should read that, but that feels kind of heavy. It actually lifted the heaviness for me. I really enjoyed it. And I really did start to kind of look in the mirror and have more self-compassion. I just want to kind of share this last thought that they stated that kind of also rang true to me. When you are cruel to yourself, contemptuous and shaming, you only increase the cruelty in the world. When you are kind and compassionate toward yourself, you increase the kindness and compassion in the world. Being compassionate toward yourself is not self-indulgent or self-pitying, but kind is both the least you can do and the single most important thing you can do to make the world a better place.
Wow. So that's a great note to end on. We wish you all kindness, self-compassion until our next episode, and go get yourself a copy of this burnout book and learn even more how to do that. We'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, I have some exciting news. Amelia Nagoski, one of the co-authors of the Burnout book, will be joining us at our upcoming Creating Trauma-Sensitive Schools conference. She'll be our keynote during the virtual portion on Friday, February 24th, 2022. Her session is entitled Burnout: What to Do When You're Overwhelmed and Exhausted About Everything You Have to Do and Still Worry That You're Not Doing Enough. We're so excited that Amelia will be there to share this with educators from all across the US and beyond. You should be there too. To find out more and to register, visit www.attachedtrauma.org/conference. See you at our 5th annual Creating Trauma-Sensitive Schools Conference in February 2022.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Check the link in the show notes to order your copy of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. Next time, Ginger and Julie are going to start a deep dive into shame, what it is, why it's so powerful, and how we can become more shame-proof. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor. Our music was donated by Joe Kramer. For more information about the Attachment Trauma Network, visit our website at attachedtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website through anchor.fm. I'm Danny Pankratz. Thanks for listening.